96.3 FM, Bathrobs Piers Broadsides, Civil Rights on the Streets, and all around the town from 9:30 to 1 o'clock. Our first guest will be Paul Marcellin Simpson?
Sampson.
Sampson, sorry there, Paul. He's going to talk about the attempts to distribute information and establish bus rider... Gosh, unions, associations, input, meaningful influence on the policies of the Metro Transit. Is that kind of cover? We're going to be rolling into that in a moment. But before we do, of course, we're going to have a little musical intro. And we've also got coming up Roxana Keys Tapache on CPS, the case of four children stolen from Stacy and Orly Jones, or let's say sequestered for their own good, of course. And then at 11:30, we'll be having the De Anza Trailer Park scandal, the attempt of the city council, actually the intention of the city council next week, September 16th, I believe, is when they're going to do it, to destroy rent control at the De Anza Trailer Park. All this and more on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Stay with us. Stay tuned.
It's been 5 years since I've had a raise in pay. Way things are going, I could get laid off any day. Sure is hard living with all this pain. I know what I need. I need somebody to blame. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got control.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They can live back.
My neighborhood library is about to close. The school my kids go to is becoming a joke. Self-serving liberals blame it on corporate tax breaks. But that's propaganda. I know who I should hate. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They've all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They've got the fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs. Who's to blame for the potholes and flooding and drought?
It's all their fault. It's all their fault.
Who's to blame for inflation, unemployment, and everything I'm pissed off about? Who's to blame for the end of the good old days? Who's to blame for the fact that I can't get laid? Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some
balls. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on
drugs.
Send them back. Send them back. Send them back. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got some balls.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
On drugs.
And, well, that's Dave Lippman from I Hate Walmart and, of course, Teenage Immigrant Welfare Mothers on Drugs. That's the one. So luckily, we know who to blame. But we also have some more people to blame. We can blame Paul Marcel and Sampson here. He's in the studio with us. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Robert.
And you are, I'm going to get this right because you've handed me the newsletter. You've been putting together a newsletter. Well, why don't you tell me about it?
I have founded a group called La Unión de los Pasajeros de Metro, the Metro Riders Union. We are a bilingual group for concerned bus riders in Santa Cruz County. And we have put together a newsletter earlier this summer in hopes of distributing it to bus riders, because we feel that handing it out in transit centers, places where bus riders are, is the best way to get our message out. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm here to talk about today.
When did you devise this newsletter? It looks like it's fairly extensive. What? 7 or 8 pages?
Yes. It's
got a bus fare jumps from $1 to $1.50 in Espanol, Pagina 5, so it's in English and Spanish, but I note it's not in Tagalog or Swahili.
No, that is true.
They're going to be working on that.
We focused on what we think are the two primary language groups, and we would welcome other inputs if possible.
Even French-speaking individuals, in spite of our president's warning about those groups.
Well, I happen to speak French, so I'd be pleased to do a feature on Freedom Fries or something like that.
Oui, très bien. You have, again, the opening page of this contrasts the old bus fares with the new bus fares. Headline stories read, South County hit hardest, Watsonville riders pay cash. And you give stories, who says you need a car, obviously encouraging people to use public transit, and describing how buses can get back and forth to Big Sur. And you answer a number of questions. You give your website, which I note here is what? http://groups.yahoo.com. It's a long one. Is there a simple way of putting it, this one?
Unfortunately not, since we don't have any funding other than mine and my partner's personal savings at this point. We've just used this free service. It's http://groups.yahoo.com/group/Metro Riders Union.
And if you want, you can just email you, Paul, at metroriders@hotmail. That perhaps is the quickest way to get that, in case you didn't have a pen or pencil handy. Again, the email address is metroriders, small letters, one word, metro, metroriders, riders, metroriders, one word, @hotmail.com.
And we love to receive email.
And so there you are. You can also email this show, rnorths2@hotmail.com, if you want to try to get a question in and someone else is on the line. That can happen because we have only one phone line coming in here to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. The phone number, however, if you want to call us, is 427-3772, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 427-3772. If you've got questions for me or Paul, please do call in. As I said, later in the show, we're going to have, in about half an hour, Roxana Kistapache is going to be talking about the CPS situation with the homeless couple whose four children are still being held by CPS after apparently being bounced from one abusive household to the next, or at least in the case of the two, in the case of all four children, according to the couple. And then at 11:30, as I mentioned, Sterling Frost of the De Anza Homeowners Association, along with Herb Ross, are coming into the studio to talk about what I call the city council sellout of the De Anza mobile home park situation, where rent control will be destroyed there. But stay with us and certainly call in 427-3772 to ask questions about Paul. I became interested, Paul, in your situation. When I read a couple stories about you in the Sentinel, or the Sent Anal, as I like to call it, because of its general lack of coverage. In your case, apparently, however, they at least have given you a couple stories. Heather Berner wrote one on June 12th about your opposing the rise in bus fares, the new group, La Unión de los Pasajeros de Metro, the Metro Riders Union that you have formed. When was that formed?
We formed the group in mid-June and sent our letter requesting recognition to Metro the second week of June.
Why would you send a letter to the Metro requesting recognition? Why not simply go directly to the community, announce who you are, organize, and then come in mass to meetings to demand that, let's say, rates be either scaled back or at least held steady?
Well, the reason that I wanted to work with Metro's board of directors is that I started here in Santa Cruz working on transit issues kind of through the back door. I got involved with Metro staff and worked with them one-on-one, had meetings with them, gathered information, and did a lot of research about the system. So I already had a dialogue with the staff of the system, and I wanted to seek some official recognition. What we needed from the board of directors was permission to speak to bus riders and hand out a newsletter to get them involved at the transit centers. We did other uh, We took other initiatives to reach the public independently, for example, working with the Sentinel, issuing press releases, starting our website. But we wanted to have, I suppose, an inalienable right to access the transit centers.
But if you have an inalienable right, why do you request it? I mean, you don't request inalienable rights. You simply assert them, and if they're denied, you demand them. I mean, it seems to me, for example, when I heard that Food Not Bombs was essentially being hassled for giving out their literature, I think one time back in 1995, 96, 97, thereabouts, Food Not Bombs, which normally doesn't serve near the metro area, was forced by inclement weather to move under the metro awning in the Pacific area, frontal area of the metro. And they were accosted by, I don't know whether it's Santa Cruz police or metro police or First Alarm Security, I don't know who they were, or metro bureaucrats, told to move on or some such thing, and they said, no, you know, bite me or whatever. And essentially a difference of opinion developed. They weren't arrested, they weren't cited, but they were pressured, as people up and down Pacific Avenue are being pressured to move along if they don't fit the stereotypes that the merchants in the downtown conservative interests somehow feel is now de rigueur for Santa Cruz. So my response to that was I whipped out a bunch of flyers, set up a table, and parked it right in the middle of the metro center. I didn't block traffic, but I was there. And they came over and said, well, we'd rather you're not here. And I said, well, I'd rather you were not repressive the way you are, so be on your way, leave me alone, or, you know, do what you need to do, but I've got information to give out. And I gave it out, and they backed off. Now, I haven't done that regularly because it's probably a good idea to give out information at the metro. In fact, it sounds like an essential if you are trying to get information out to metro riders. So what's been your experience there? Have you attempted to distribute and found yourself told or what's cooking there?
Well, first of all, let me address your last comment about how it seems common sense that we would want to address people at Metro Center. Mm-hmm. The official Metro Advisory Group doesn't communicate with the public at all, and certainly doesn't use that communication vehicle. So
you were on that
first.
For about a year, right?
About half a year, yeah. And I really admire you for taking direct action, setting up a table and protesting resistance to public expression on Pacific and at Metro Center. For me, being somebody who's not white, I'm very, very scared of police, and especially in this country. I grew up in Canada, and I suppose had a greater level of confidence in civic institutions like the police. We're now seeing some problems surface there, even in Canada, with racial profiling and things like that. But I'm very scared of confrontations with the authorities, so I wanted to take a policy approach and get the district to state its policy. I suppose the other concern is that, while I'm founding the group and my partner's working on it and we have a number of volunteers and helpers in the community, we're not always going to be here. The goal is to have a group that is self-supporting and really run by the average bus riders, not people with specialized knowledge. So we want to have policies in place that allow them to express their views and get work done, realizing that, not everyone will be able to invest the amount of time and not everyone can take risks like the one that you took, setting up a table and fighting actively.
Well, those are quite sensible and understandable reasons for not wanting to, invite police officers to intersect your face with their have you assault their batons with your face, as often is the claim when you get to court. Well, actually, I've got to be very candid. I've not been attacked physically by any police officer in this town. I want to make that clear, but I do know people who have. So I can appreciate what you're saying. Tell me a little bit about the history of what you did. Did you initially try to do any distributing just sort of as a matter of course and were stopped? Or did you think, well, I first want to get permission before I even begin starting to give out flyers? What happened there?
Well, I suppose, big secret, we did try in very discreet ways.
Oh, ho, criminal. Let me call the police here. Just want to make a quick phone call here. Go ahead.
In very discreet ways to distribute small numbers of the newsletters, mostly as a test. I would leave them in the back seat of a bus or on a bench. Very similar to the technique.
Littering, eh?
Yes. Very similar to the techniques that, for example, the Jehovah's Witnesses or a religious group uses on buses and at Metro Center. And I figured that's a safe way of testing the waters. The problem is that you don't know who's going to come along and pick up the newsletter. newsletter. We spent money providing postage paid stamped cards that people could mail in, you know, if they don't have time to come to meetings, maybe they still have ideas to share. So, you know, there's a certain cost associated with each newsletter. We print them at home, all of that. So we really want to make everyone count. We can't over-distribute. We have to limit the number that we print. So I tried the discrete method and then wanted to get permission to do it in person, talk to people one-on-one at the centers.
I mean, if you, I'm sure that that I, frankly, could find volunteers who would be willing to stand at the bus area and give out this newsletter, and you yourself would not be liable. Of course, you would be maligned, no doubt, by some who would say that you were associating with questionable activists. That's always a, well, that's often the consequence of associating with, for example, members of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, or folks like Steve Argue, who was... He was beaten for selling a street newspaper in 1988. He wasn't beaten for selling it. He was told to stop selling it. He was in front of the New Leaf Market, and he said, "I beg your pardon, it's completely legal." And he was brought down to the sidewalk by Officer Garner. We call him Grim Grip Garner, and a CSO, taken to jail, held for 4 days, and then released without charges, and he sued the city for damages, and I believe he recovered significant money for that and now continues to sell the paper on the street regularly. That's not particularly encouraging to you, of course, but that is, but since then, people have not been arrested for selling street newspapers, and we do sell, for those who are interested, street spirit, that is to say, homeless people who want to sell a paper that they don't have to pay for, but they go out and sell it for essentially as an alternative to panhandling. It gets out news, it provides for communication in a more socially respectable and I think actually educationally effective way. It reassures middle class people who don't know quite how to deal with the sight of a homeless person on the streets. So that's done. And it was done, as I said, because people stood up. And I'm not saying that everyone has to use the same approach. I don't think they should. I think people should have got to tailor their approach to how they, what their particular needs are, their particular skin color as well. You know, I mean, have you got any allies in this particular struggle to be able to give out literature in a public place?
Well, I suppose the first step toward getting allies is making people aware of what we're doing. It's almost a catch-22 or chicken and egg problem, because the newsletter was our big push to get people to recognize the name, and we have certainly found we've certainly found a willingness on the part of the Sentinel to publish information about us. We found a volunteer in the community who assisted us with the Spanish translation of the newsletter. My partner and I are both intermediate Spanish students, but we're not able to write a production like that entirely on our own. So we found people who have come forward and assisted us. We would love to have volunteers to distribute the newsletter and to get involved with the group, maintaining the website and helping us set policy, appearing at board meetings. Any volunteers are more than welcome to help. We would really appreciate it.
It's interesting. I'm looking at this story by Heather Berner, who has written three stories about you and the group. We're talking with Paul Marcel and Sampson here of the Metro Writers Association? Metro, is that right?
Metro Writers Union.
Metro Writers Union. If you want more information about that, again, the email address to contact is?
It's metrowriters@hotmail.com. You're also welcome to call us, 831-421-9031. That's the number for the association and also my personal number.
Give that number again, could you, Paul?
That's 831-421-9031.
So you can also call the station if you have any thoughts or comments, if you're a bus rider or merely a free speech advocate or possibly feeling a little concerned about the possibility of the bus depot being taken over by mobs of anarchistic types, strange Spanish-speaking individuals with peculiar literature. 427-3772 is the number to call here at Free Radio, or you can email rnorse2@hotmail.com in case you want to get in and you haven't been able to do it on the phone, or you have a strange affection for email. You can give us a call there. Hey, the phone line is open if you would like to talk. I guess I'm wondering, it's interesting. The laws of the downtown ordinances in Santa Cruz were originally proposed by Neil Coonerty of the Bookshop Santa Cruz to be much more repressive than they are. And They came out of the downtown commission back in 1994, and they were saying you had to be things like 10 feet from a bench to give out political literature, and people realized that that wasn't going to fly too well through City of Santa Cruz, and those were dropped. They just made it you couldn't sit within initially 6 feet of a building, now 14 feet of a building in the downtown area, which effectively eliminates 95% of the sitting space downtown on the sidewalk, even if you're not blocking it. I continue to bring this up because I think it's absurd and an abusive example of what's going on all around the country directed against poor and homeless people. If you're not poor, you don't need to sit on the sidewalk. You can go sit in a street cafe or somewhere else. If you are, you have to deal with that. And, of course, you deal with this paranoia that the merchants have about having the wrong kind of people in front of their stores. I think you're facing a similar kind of fear and bigotry from, I don't know, I mean, some of this is you're cautious because you felt, I guess, repressed by... You probably haven't heard the stories I've told, but you don't want to risk the legal entanglements of being cited and arrested, the possible fines, the court time, and so ironically, you're spending another amount of time going through an administrative process that you hope will set up laws and codes that will enable you to feel some kind of security and protection. Is that clear?
Yeah, that's a good way of summing it up. We would feel safer having a policy that we can point to if a security guard or a police officer or some other authority figure approaches us when we're speaking. Policy says X number of feet away from the bus door, or this bench is the designated public speech area, something like that, we can point to and hopefully avoid confrontations and misunderstandings.
Yeah, the problem I find with that, and although I wish you luck with that, definitely wish you luck, is that we already have a policy, a thing called the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which says the burden is seriously on authorities to show that there is a significant governmental interest served in stopping you from doing what you're doing or regulating what you're doing. Looks like we got a caller here. Let's see what's up. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, I tuned in a bit late, but I guess I'm curious about the Metro, and they take ads, right? They put, like, huge billboards on their buses for, big fast food restaurants and other things like that, but they're going to regulate people handing out flyers? Is that what I'm hearing?
Give me that question again there,
Well,
Paul.
I guess I'm trying to get some clarification about that. Like, are they regulating people handing out literature at the Metro?
Well,
same Metro who takes ad money to put billboards on the sides of buses?
You want to answer
commercial
that
speech is my point.
Yeah, go ahead.
They'll take money for commercial speech, but if I want to go hand out a free radio schedule or something, I would get what? What would happen to me?
Well, you just quoted Metro's advertising policy. Metro instituted a new policy, I believe, last year, restricting all external bus advertising to what's called the commercial forum. In other words, for-profit companies and for-profit ads. That issue was under discussion last Friday at the board meeting because we right now have the Regional Transportation Commission, which is a county organization. They're spending $500,000 on a campaign to encourage bicycling, use of carpools, use of the bus, alternative commuting methods, and they're willing to pay for advertising on the sides of Metro buses. This is another government organization. You could call it a senior organization.
Right.
It's at a level higher than Metro, and Metro's advertising policy doesn't allow ads for Metro's own bus service.
Wow.
And the board has shown a tremendous... I guess they've been nitpicking over this, and they want to redesign the campaign, and they don't want to even allow this kind of non-commercial advertising for transit promotion on their buses. So it's a great question. Thank you for raising that point.
Thanks for clarifying that. Hey, Robert, can you take me off for a minute? I got to talk to you real quick.
Sure. Hang on just a second. Go ahead. Oh, wait a minute. I got to figure out how to do that.
Well, I just wanted to let you know, I can just tell you on the air, that the computer is still coming through the phone.
Oh, it is.
And so maybe you might want to hit stop on that thing or something.
Okay, let me take a look and see what I can...
Thanks.
Yeah, thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye. Yeah, let me know, V-Man, if that's continuing. I've turned down the volume on the computer, and I've tried to cut the computer, but I'm having trouble doing that. You're dealing with a marketing company. Oops. As you can hear, we have a kind of a grassroots approach to the situation. You're in the studio here with Paul Marcel and Sampson of the Metro Writers Union, who is trying to thread his way through what sounds like, frankly, a series of unnecessary and inappropriate obstacles to what should be basic First Amendment activity. Who's on the board, Paul, that seems to be blocking this? I mean, what interests are involved?
The board looks a lot like the county Board of Supervisors and Santa Cruz City Council, with a few folks sprinkled in.
Oh, isn't Mike Rotkin, our great socialist free speech advocate, standing up for you?
He is on the board, and whether he stands up for us or not, we'll wait and see.
Hi, you're on Free Radio with Paul and Robert.
Hello, Paul and Robert. Paul, this is Steve Argue. I've been hassled passing out literature at the bus station, and I want to tell you that story in a minute, but I didn't hear exactly what was going on with your situation. They're not letting you pass out your literature at the station?
Well, what I was told when I first asked the question is that there was a policy against free speech activities at the station. No one was ever able to produce the policy, and I stepped forward and said that we would like permission to do this, and I gave, you know, very, very limited conditions under which we'd be doing free speech activities. We wanted to try to sit at benches a limited number of hours and days each month, and only engage people who wanted to speak with us and hand them a copy of our newsletter. Very simple request.
Right.
About 4 months later, here we are hashing out the details. I did have a meeting with Metro's district council last week to identify some possible free speech zones at the stations. We took out the measuring tape and took photos and things like this. It's gotten to that that kind of technical level.
Okay.
The board turned down a policy, a broader policy, a few weeks
ago. Here's my experience. When I was running for city council, of course I wanted to reach people at the bus station, and I've handed out other literature there too. And while I was handing out my campaign literature there, a security guard came up, and this happened to me a couple different times. A security guard came up this one time, and he says I can't be doing that. And of course I replied as a free speech activist as well. I replied, well, this is my constitutional right. It's the First Amendment to the Constitution. There have been court rulings about places like this being public places, and the First Amendment does apply. And the security guard threatened me with arrest, and I refused to stop handing out the literature. He called for the police to come over or called on his radio for some police, and then he left, and then I guess he talked to them on the phone or something. He came back and he asked me again to leave the area to go onto the public sidewalk, and at that point I said, well, this is public anyway, but that's beside the point. Whether this was privately owned or public, this would still be my right. And he said, well, if it was up to me, I'd have you arrested. But the police have told me that you will only use it against us, and so we can't do anything. So, and then I continued to do it, and I've passed out literature at the bus station many times. So, my advice is not to wait for some policy, but to just stand up for the right to be there and do it.
Yeah, my advice is that too, Paul. And I think if you're a little apprehensive about having, you know, a confrontation with the police, have somebody with you who's done it before. Have somebody with a video camera nearby. That's what we did in front of the Pacific Trading Company, and I think that can reassure you. What do you think about that, caller?
Yeah, that's good advice as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they shouldn't be hassling you like that, I hope you do get out there and do that, because there's a lot that needs to be done. This 50-cent raise in the bus fare, I think, is really unreasonable. You know, it's a service that poor people need. It's a service that keeps fewer cars on the street, and it really needs to be subsidized more to keep the price down.
You know, and it's interesting. We're stuck talking about these First Amendment issues, about the right to talk, instead of giving you the opportunity to talk about the substantive issues.
Right.
Maybe we
so,
should give
so
you
I'll get
off
the air
that too, you know. Thank you, caller.
Okay, thanks.
Steven, if you can, later call into the show and talk about your case and how it's going with the move-along. I know you've been arrested twice for having a table for 61 minutes on Pacific Avenue.
Hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you, Steve.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
What are the issues that essentially it looks like they're preventing you from getting out through this policy, or they're interfering with?
I'm going to shoot myself in the foot a number of times from various sides. I am one who never shies away from controversy here. Let me say before I get into the substantive issues that our views as a writers' union are conflicted. We don't have a 15-second soundbite story about the fare increase or about some of these other policy changes that are going on at Metro, and there's a risk that people from the progressive and from the less progressive sides will be offended by some of these views. We're steering an economically based.
You could take them to a policy board first and wait 4 months before talking about them if you'd like.
No, I just wanted to prefix these remarks, so please don't brand me as being anti anything until you've heard the whole story. I started out as an advocate for the fare increase, working directly with staff to come up with a fare increase package. In other words, a package that spread the burden in an equitable way across all of the rider groups. The reason I supported the fare increase initially is that I think transit riders need to have a greater voice in provision of transit service. Typically, you have non-riders, experts, politicians making decisions about our service levels, and when they run out of money, they decide to make cuts. And under those circumstances, I think many of us as transit riders would rather pay a little bit more than lose our bus service, because it is our wheels, it's our way of getting around. So initially, realizing that there was no more money, that the district was facing a $2.4 million deficit this year, I was a supporter of a fare increase that would have helped us keep or add service. At that point, we were just fighting to stay above water and keep a certain level of keep the existing level of bus service. What I discovered along the way, after speaking up in favor of a fare increase for the sake of saving transit service, is that a lot of the money goes to operational inefficiencies, and so I had to revise my position on the fare increase.
What would those be, operational inefficiencies?
Well, this transit agency started very small. It actually operated out of the back room of a house, from what I've told, for many years, and was kind of the poor stepchild of the city of Santa Cruz. And it's only in the last few years, with thoroughly professional management staff, that they've begun to make changes. But for example, we have a bus schedule that was designed many years ago and uses very traditional methods. For example, the bus stops at the same place every 15 minutes throughout the day. It starts at the same time Sunday morning as it does on Saturday morning, as it does Monday through Friday. The schedule is not tailored to the actual needs of travelers, and it might be possible to save some money if we tinkered with some of the scheduling assumptions. It would be possible, and other transit agencies have saved hundreds of thousands, if not millions, by trimming a little bit of service at 5 a.m. Sunday morning, adding service on Friday night when people might actually be riding, making little changes to the schedule that change the assumptions. Maybe the bus comes every 17 minutes instead of every 15 minutes, and that saves you 2 hours of driving time under your contract because of work rules and break time provisions and other things like that. And this agency has not been willing to consider those kinds of efficiencies.
Is it the city council members on the board of SUPS who essentially run this stop the policy, or is it a bunch of staff bureaucrats at the city council and the board of SUPS listen to that stop the policy from changing or being flexible?
I would say that it's mostly political. These are policy decisions, and were there an interest in running a more efficient shop, the board would say that to the staff, and the staff would do it. We have a wonderful general manager here, top in the country, and he is very much open to these kinds of ideas.
What's his name?
His name is Mr. Leslie R. White.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a wonderful resource, very much in favor of running an efficient system. But you've got to have the political will at the top to make big changes.
The top being?
In this case, the board.
And the board, again, consists of, of volunteers from both the SUPS and the city council?
Yes, Santa Cruz City Council, County Board of Supervisors, and then appointments from Watsonville and Capitola.
How big is the board?
The board is an 11-member board. There's one ex officio, as a non-voting member from UCSC as well.
And who's on the city council? Who's on the board?
Emily Riley, Mike Rotkin.
Who's on the SUPS? Who's on the board?
Jeff Almquist, and I'm trying to remember. I don't have all the I don't
Butes,
have all the names.
Wormhout.
Yes, Butes is on there. Uh-huh. Wormhout is not.
We got a call here. Let's see. You're talking with Paul, Marcel, and Sampson of the Metro Writers Union. Hi there. You're on the air with the two of us.
Hi, this is Matt from Santa Cruz.
Hey, Matt.
I'd like to ask about, okay, this advertising thing. They did seem to have billboards at one point on some public service topics, like there was one against domestic violence. Hello?
Yes, it's possible that they did in the past. No more, though. The policy forbids it henceforth.
No, I can't hear the guest, Robert.
Said the policy forbids it.
Why?
The district wanted to gain revenue from commercial advertising and not run the risk of having ads that might be perceived as offensive or inappropriate by the public. So the district restricted advertising to strictly commercial purposes.
Oh, okay. So they won't have any more ads on there about, you know, like the domestic violence or anything like that, huh?
No, as I said earlier, right now they cannot even advertise their own bus service on the sides of their buses.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes, it is.
When did that policy change, Paul?
I believe it was last year. I don't have the exact date.
And are the minutes of that meeting available so we can find out whether our fine city council members voted for that strange new policy?
Yes, most of these decisions are made unanimously, I should say, but I don't know the exact voting mix.
Well, we want to keep a strong front. And we are, of course, at orange alert, or is it yellow alert? I'm not sure which.
Right.
Terrorists are everywhere. You know, you could have terrorists putting up billboards on buses or giving out flyers in the metro station, and that could alarm the populace.
If you are interested in checking minutes and keeping up with the decisions that the board makes, www.scmtd, that's Santa Cruz Metropolitan Transit District, .com. That's www.scmtd.com.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, caller. Bye-bye. Free Radio Santa Cruz has an open phone line, 427-3772. You're on the air with Paul and Robert. We're talking about... the right to free speech at the Metro Transit Center, the right to have some meaningful policies actually that are writer-instituted or at least writer-influenced. You want to talk more about the kinds of policies you'd like to see that are apparently not currently the case that you're going to be talking about in this newsletter if they don't stop you from distributing it?
Thank you. Yes. I wanted to get back to the topic of the fare increase and my own change of heart regarding the fare increase. One of the other really difficult problems, and it's not a clear-cut problem by any means, but one of the problems with public transit is that the cost of operating the service is really out of control. And the main factor in that cost, unfortunately, is the wages that are paid to the employees of the transit district. Before anyone brands me as anti-labor or anti-union, I volunteer with local unions, and I have a very strong pro-labor orientation in my own political beliefs. I'm all for workers' rights. But we have bus drivers at Santa Cruz Metro who earn now $22.66 an hour, and next year, all drivers with 5 years or more of experience will be earning $24.80 an hour. Those wages are top in the country. Obviously, we also live in one of the most expensive areas in the country. But, you know, when you have a service that is primarily for low-income folks, people here, unfortunately, don't ride transit because they like it. They ride transit because they have to. Shouldn't be that way, but it is. And these people are funding, I'd say, Cadillac salaries and wages at the district. You have a real social problem there. It's robbing Peter to pay Paul, and that's one of my other concerns.
How much of this goes into administration rather than the actual people who are doing the driving? Do you have any breakdown on that?
I don't have an exact number, but Metro has a very small administration relative to other agencies. It's been cut back tremendously to the point that it's very difficult to do things that other transit agencies do. For example, detailed studies of ridership, things like that. There's very little administration.
Well, do you have
overhead.
A big guy at the top who gets a huge salary like Dick Wilson's, our city manager for life, with $160,000 plus a year salary, or what do we got at the Metro?
Well, Les White would receive a salary, I believe, in that bracket. It's definitely over 100,000, but the man works 7 days a week, and I can call him at work at 9 at night. I think he earns every penny that he gets.
Mm-hmm. Are you looking for, like, assistance in distributing this flyer, or are you? This is a question I should ask you later. But I mean, I think that there are people out there who are willing to help you do some distribution, and who would actually go out and distribute it and take the risk of arrest. I know I would. I would be happy to go distribute this flyer at the Metro to riders who want it. I'm a little bit alarmed looking at this story by Heather Berner, the most recent one, which talks about the negotiations you're getting into. Transit directors consider how and where to allow lobbying August 29th. It says, a discussion last week, the board is, right now the district has no policy on public lobbying at its centers, which it shouldn't. It's a First Amendment activity. You should go out and do it. Its policy, it does have a policy. Its policy is don't do it. There's no First Amendment permitted, apparently, at the centers in terms of this kind of distribution. At least that's what it sounds like you were told. However, according to this, there's a recent Supreme Court decision. I'm not sure what decision that was. Do you know? I don't either, but I'd like to find out. I mean, it doesn't sound like I don't think it's a recent Supreme Court decision. I think there is, in fact, maybe if some transit district somewhere tried to harass people and the Supreme Court said, remember, there is a First Amendment around there, folks, so watch out. But there's been a First Amendment since 1789, or since it was ratified in 1790 and 91. So, you know, I'm a little bit concerned now. The district has no policy. The board is struggling with where and how to allow public advocacy, writes Heather Berner, near public transportation. A discussion last week indicated that board members are leaning toward restricting it to tables at the corner of the station or requiring activists to stay at least 10 feet away from bus and metro building doors. In Santa Cruz, that would mean they would be required to stay at the edges of the station or on the middle island of the station. The board is addressing the issue because the newly formed Metro Riders Union has asked the board to allow it to hand out its newsletter and recruit members. I'm a little worried that you're making this request instead of simply asserting your rights is setting us up to have massive restrictions like they do, for example, when Bush comes to town. They give you a protest pen 3 miles away from the protest or, you know, many, many blocks away. Is that a concern of yours?
It is a concern, and we are fighting for a policy that is as open as possible. Since we're here to promote transit and really act as rider advocates, we don't want to do anything that would interfere with the public's use of the transit center. For example, one island at Metro Center or one platform is somewhat narrow. It's about 11 feet across, and if you have passengers who are disembarking, passengers in wheelchairs or people with walkers, there are concerns about accessibility and free flow of people through the center. So we're trying to strike a balance. And I'm the first one who has stood up for sites that are visible in the transit center. The middle island is not good enough for me, being in the back corner, being on the extreme end of the transit center or on the public sidewalk, because that's not where bus riders wait. That's not where we can reach people. So I'm fighting for the broadest policy. Anyone else who would like to join the fight is welcome to have an audience with Metro staff or to attend any of the board meetings. And we're going 2 meetings a month, and this comes up every 2 weeks.
Not that I want to go to any of these board meetings or even advise people to go, but certainly to support you would be good. But when is the next board meeting?
The next board meeting will be the fourth Friday. The board meetings are always the second and fourth Fridays of the month. I don't have the exact date in my mind right now, but check www.scmtd.com.
What time are these meetings?
They begin at 9 o'clock.
9 a.m.?
Yes. The first meeting of the month is held at the district headquarters, which is in the Harvey West Business Park, not necessarily accessible to people. There is a bus that runs in front, but it's not the best place. The second and final meeting of the month is always held in Santa Cruz City Council Chambers, so that's a very accessible location.
One of my favorite spots. You're talking to Paul Marcelin Sampson of the Metro Riders Union. We're coming to the end of this segment. Gosh, Paul, I wish you could stay longer, but we have another guest in the studio that has got stuff to talk about, too. Are you considering having, let's say, a public meeting on this issue where people who are interested in being supportive could come and volunteer to help, give their experience, maybe where attorneys could volunteer and say, if they come after you, we will defend you. Not that that happens much, but who knows? You know, there's attorneys who stepped out of the woodwork to help defend the move-along law and against a move-along law and defend against a homeless man with a sign that said, fuck the pigs, on his hat. It seems to me if that's defensible, and it is, and the police department has backed down from that one, they certainly should back down from this, although yours, of course, is a substantive issue. Apparently, they're maybe a little bit worried about criticism, and I notice at the end of this article, There's also a statement, the board's biggest fear is not Metro Writers Union founder Paul Marcelin Sampson, who said he wants to just sit on benches and hand out newsletters. I hope you want to do more than that, but I'm glad you want to do that at least. But the more aggressive political activists in downtown Santa Cruz, there are groups out there who are intent on not winning people over to their side, but getting in your face, said supervisor and Metro board member Jan Butes. And I think that people like Mr. Marcelin will find that they don't want to irritate writers either. So I think they're talking about the activists downtown they don't like, and they're saying that they want to somehow tailor their restrictions to go after the people they don't like, which, of course, is content-based. It's really what they're trying to do. And, of course, what it affects your content, too. So I would encourage you to consider holding a meeting of some kind where everyone could come or... Anyway, I mean, you certainly have offered yourself here for our public discussion on the air. And again, your email address is?
It's metrowriters@hotmail.com. metrowritersunion@hotmail.com.
And your phone number is?
831-421-9031.
We're going to take this last call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Good morning. This is David calling in.
Aha. You are right on time there, David. Actually, you're a little bit ahead of time. I'm glad you're calling in. Can you hang for a second? We got to say goodbye to our guest here and then put you on, or alternately, can you call back in 5 minutes?
Sure.
I'm sorry to be so...
No problem. I'll call back.
Sure. Please do, David. Make it 8 minutes, if you can, or make it a little bit longer.
Pardon?
Me, in fact, I should say, punish me for doing this silently at City Council. You're acting like a pack of fascist Chester. You wanted to pass me a note. You said, would you like to talk, wants to talk about the policy about equal fares. What is this you want to speak about?
This is probably the key part of the Writers Union's policy platform, is to make sure that people pay an equal bus fare, no matter what the people look like, where they live, that we start with an equal fare, and also that we distribute the public resources that are used to support the service. It's a heavily subsidized service. About 80% of the cost, between 75 and 80%, comes from various sources of local, state, and federal tax revenue. And we want to make sure that service is allocated fairly, that we don't have empty buses going up into the hills and crowded ones on the streets in Watsonville, for example. The equal fare policy suggests that the district lower its cash fare and make the cash fare the only fare that is available. There would be no more passes. There would be no more special discounts. Right now, if you have a lot of cash, you can buy a $50 monthly pass that pays for itself in 12 days. And that comes at the expense of the folks who do not have $50 cash at the beginning of the month and wind up putting in $1.50 every time they board the bus. They spent about $400,000 subsidizing monthly passes last year. We gave away 500,000 transit rides to our monthly pass holders last year at the expense of poorer people who do not have the cash to buy monthly passes or whose work schedules differ.
Paul, would you like to come on again next week at this time and kind of continue this conversation? It sounds like we're nowhere near finished. And I also think this is something that is going to need, obviously, more organizing. And I think this radio station and this opportunity may be a place for you to do it. Would you be up for coming on next week?
I would be honored to. I really appreciate your listeners' willingness to hear this and your willingness to let us discuss policy issues here. It's not often in the media that we get a chance to talk about real policy.
Okay, well, then we're going to do that next week at 9:30. We're going to return at the same time here on Free Radio Santa Cruz with Paul Marcelin Sampson of the Metro Writers Union. And again, I would hope that in the interim, all you folks who want to do a little flyer distribution down at the Metro, check it out. And if you have any problems down there, please give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and we will just roll our table right into the Metro and see what we can do, or at least roll some flyers in there, maybe with a video camera and a tape recorder or two, to see just how the First Amendment is faring at the hands of Mayor Smiley Riley and, of course, Riot Act Rotkin, as I like to call him, the man who doesn't want names of council members said aloud at City Council. Hey, thank you for being with us, Paul. And in the meantime, people can reach you at which phone number?
At 831-421-9031.
And they can also contact you at your email address?
MetroRidersUnion@hotmail.com.
Hey, thank you for being with us. And feel free to hang around if you want.
Thank you.
All righty. So, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, and we're going to give you a bit of music, and then we're going to move to Roxana Quistapache and the case of CPS activity in the seizure of the children of Orly and Stacy Jones. Stay with us. Thank you.
I've always hated Blockbuster.
Target, McDonald's,
The Gap,
Pepsi,
Nike,
IBM,
Starbucks, not quite so much. If I'm not boycotting at least three oil companies, I start to feel out of touch. I wouldn't be seen in Nordstrom or any such. And I hate Walmart. I don't like whips. I don't like chains. I don't go chopping up my neighbor's brains. Don't really even like shopping except at the flea market. I hate Walmart. Now you may wonder, what's all this fuss? If you don't like the train, take the bus. Well, I found religion, and just between us, I hate Walmart. If you didn't hear the story, well, here's how it is. Big company sell below cost, drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land, one big square store, identical brand, and that's why I hate Walmart. Used to be you drive around, stop in on three or four towns, encounter different sights and sounds, different if not unique. Different accents, different smells, different things to buy and sell. Now it's all Taco Bell, I hate Walmart. Used to bad wine, you ride slow, relax your mind. Never knew what you'd find around the next bend. But now the freeway goes so straight, it go right past the pearly gate. I don't feel human, I feel like freight. I hate Walmart. I like to roam, I like to greet individuals on the street. You always know the one you meet is one of a kind. But more and more, they seem to me reflection of something on TV. When we're all alike, nobody's free. I hate Walmart. I boycott Burger King. I boycott New Gingrich. I boycott everything which I've seen advertised. I used to go out for dinner in a diner. Now they say fast food is finer, but it tastes like it fell out of an airliner. It's enough to make you weep. I don't like board games. I don't like brand names. They make inflated claims. They're full of bleep. Everyone I meet is a high-tech killer. Wants to sell me a digital potato peeler. And I don't like Garrison Keillor, cause he's so white. Turn on my radio dial. Like to hear something new once in a while. But it's the same old crap in a brand new style. It's audio rape. Still I try to pick and choose. I turn the dial, but always lose. Once in a while, if you're lucky, maybe one little rhythm and blues, and that's why God made tape. Used to be we wore beads and bells, made our own clothes in our own way. Now we all wear uniforms at Hard Rock Cafe. We're in a state of sartorial decay, and that's why I hate Walmart. There's a pretty spot to pave it over. Put a clover leaf over a four-leaf clover. Black paint on the white cliffs of Dover. It never fails. Hope you like this song. Thanks a bunch. Could go on, but I got a great lunch. If you didn't like it, I've got a hunch. You work in sales. Don't grow your own. Make your own. Be careful what you own. Develop non-shopping to an art. And whatever you do, don't shop at Walmart.
And that was Dave Lippmann, I Hate Walmart, from the CD of the same name. There are many who say, I hate Roxana Kistapache, and she's in the studio with us. Hi, Roxanne.
I can't believe that.
Well,
that
it's true.
That can't be true.
We can call Chris Crown. We can call Mike Rotkin. I think that they might not say that.
Let's call Marty Wormout.
We could call Smarty Marty, and that's our, one of our supervisors, and she might, who knows what she would say.
Can I make an announcement before we start?
Go for it, please.
I'm doing this on no coffee. And it's a very serious subject. So if anyone is out there who knows I'm here with no coffee and knows where I am, if you would bring coffee, I would love you forever. And I just want to say this, Bernard, remember how I kiss you on the top of the head every time I see you? Steve Argue, remember how I told you I'd vote for you no matter what you ran for? Becky, I love you. You know that.
All right, that's enough. We've had enough of these personal messages. Thank you very much, all of you. Maybe and Colleen Crosby of the Coffee Roasting Company, please bring us coffee. And Jerry Henry,
you know,
let him back in the roasting company. Well, these are Roxanne. You are with Independent Advocates, a group that is concerned with keeping an eye on different agencies, but also, I guess, most recently and particularly, the CPS Child Protective Services.
Not most recently, for 4 years, constantly. Mm-hmm. That is the only reason that independent advocacy exists. We've expanded our services, but it started with CPS's problems.
So, I know that we've talked a bit about Orly and Stacy Jones, whose 4 children were taken in April from their, is it mobile home or trailer? I'm not sure.
Actually, from a recreational vehicle that sleeps 6.
From an RV. They'd come out from Kentucky because, well, actually, we did a long interview with them, which we may play at a future show, and we've actually talked about this before. Medical marijuana was something that I guess Orly uses for different physical problems he has. And
actually, mainly for glaucoma. The drops that you take, I think, actually gave him a heart attack, so he's using it in lieu of to keep his sight longer. And
And he heard rumors that California was a land where at least you could somehow try to duck the feds while someone getting some kind of support, at least if you're one of the 5% who's a member of WAM, which he isn't, but gosh, hopefully in the future you never can tell what'll happen. Maybe the city council, maybe the community will rise up and say everybody who uses medical marijuana should be entitled to protection, not just one small favored group led by the corrals. Actually, that issue is coming up today at WAM, and WAM has a WAM fest today at San Lorenzo Park. It's going on even now from 10 to 5. However, we have a phone call. Hi, you're on the air with Free Radio.
Hello, Robert. This is David calling.
This is the patient attorney, David Beauvais.
It is.
On
How
Sunday.
Are you?
I mean, where do you get off? Where do we get off calling you on Sunday and not paying you a penny to come on the air?
I don't know, but I'm on double time today, so you better talk fast.
Okay, well, we got Roxanne in the studio. She's had a conversation with you, and you've apparently had a case where you have been able to secure some kind of payback from CPS.
We did, yes. We did. We filed a federal civil rights action based on the illegal removal of children from their mother's custody by CPS without a warrant.
David, can you tell me if a warrant is always necessary? Because I've never heard of one being used.
Found out in discovery on this case was that social workers routinely ignore the warrant requirement, and they just go to the home, take the child, or they go to the child's school and take the child, and they do it without a warrant. And it doesn't matter whether the child's taken from home or from school or any other place. There has to be a warrant unless there is imminent danger of serious physical harm or death.
And I was also told that the school is not allowed to let children go without seeing a warrant, and they do it, they lay down and do it every time.
Now, that I'm not sure of. I'm not sure what the school's duty would be in that situation. It's an interesting question, but I haven't come across anything that talks about it. I haven't looked for it either.
Oh,
David, what law requires CPS to use that wording, as you said, imminent danger only, skipping a warrant only in that case?
Well, there's basically at least 2 different bases for that. One is Welfare and Institutions Code Section 306, which outlines the need for a court order to remove a child which basically says that there has to be a case of physical abuse or sexual abuse. In addition to that, there's a precedent in the Ninth Circuit, which is a matter of federal constitutional law, the Fourth and Fourteenth Amendments. The court has said repeatedly that there has to be a warrant for removal of a child unless there is imminent danger to the child of physical harm.
What's the ruling case in that people should consult?
There's several of them. One is Calabretta versus San Bernardino County. There's another case called Rubin versus somebody out of Hawaii back in 95. I don't have these cases in front of me because I'm in my car.
Mm-hmm.
But there's several cases. And now the case that I had is another case that's published on that same point.
And what is that case?
That case is called Moodian versus Alameda County.
How do you spell it?
M-O-O-D-I-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a U.S. District Court decision that appears, I don't know what the site is, it's in the Federal Supplement 2nd.
David, I wanted to ask you a couple questions. You and I talked yesterday, and I mentioned spanking, and you said, so what? Is spanking against the law?
Spanking on the buttocks is okay as long as it doesn't leave a mark.
Okay, because CPS would have you believe that all spanking is coercion. So
no, actually, there's a specific section in the code about it.
But the workers themselves.
What code section is that, David? Do you know?
I don't know what the spanking code is. It could be 300A of the Welfare and Institutions Code, but I'm not sure of that because I don't have all that in front of me. But there is a specific provision relating to spanking.
And then I was talking to the supervising attorney of the attorney for my clients, and he said that basically, unless you do everything CPS says, if you fight them in any way, you will lose your case. You have to jump through every hoop. He said that you had to have the time management skills of President Bush's staff, that you could not argue about anything or it would get you in so much trouble.
Well,
do you agree?
That raises a number of interesting issues. I think the primary problem with that is that most of the parents or children that get sucked into the system are poor.
Yeah.
And these are people who are living on a survival plane of existence, who are already overburdened and overwhelmed by life just in general. And on top of that, you're adding to that stress by requiring the parents to go through a case plan that they're literally bound to fail, because they have to continue to meet all of these appointments with social workers, psychologists. They have to go to the parenting classes, the anger management classes, and they have to do all of these things and still maintain a household, perhaps work, take care of small children. There's so much pressure on a parent who's being dragged through this system that only the most resourceful and the most energetic are going to make it through, and even then there's no guarantee. So that's one problem. The other issue is, I disagree with the public defender that you should not fight these cases. Now, this gets down to a case-by-case analysis of what the best strategy is for the parent to take. But the blanket idea that you should roll over and not contest allegations against you is just absurd, especially if it's not true or if it's been exaggerated. Frequently, it's a good idea to go to trial if only to show the court what the reasoning was or what the situation was that led to whatever problems arose. And I say, you know, in most instances, it's appropriate to challenge the social workers, particularly if there's falsehoods in their reports. Frequently, they rely on evidence that's not very reliable. Anyone can drop a dime, I guess 35 cents now, and make a call to CPS and make some kind of an allegation against someone. And the way the system is structured now, child can be removed just based on that.
But with a warrant, right?
Without a warrant. I mean, that's how it's done in practice. Now, during the case that I had, the federal case that we sued for damages, I took the deposition of one of the higher people in the department, who said we just don't get warrants. We don't bother with warrants. It was like they didn't even know that the law required them to have one. It was very scary. And this has been my experience in all the counties in the state that I've worked in involving CPS issues, or I've talked to people who have.
What counties are those, David?
Well, what counties are what?
What counties have you worked in?
Alameda, Marin, Contra Costa, San Joaquin, Fresno, several of them. Mm-hmm. But I also know, just as a routine, that nowhere in the state that I can find is the warrant requirement being respected.
I work with an ex-district attorney investigator in Long Beach who's my advisor. He knows that a warrant is necessary. We've known that for years. We just haven't known what to do about it because the schools roll over. Everyone rolls over. They take babies that are not tox positive for other reasons out of hospitals without a warrant. Do you know, for instance, David, like when you've lost a child before, can someone just remove your baby from your next baby from the hospital without a warrant? I mean, my information is that no one asks to see the warrant.
Right. No, I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say just because another child's been removed that the new child could be removed on because other children have been removed.
Well, that's what they're doing now. That is at, they claim that is
but,
in the code.
You know, the fact that other children have been removed does play into the whole context of the case and certainly would tilt the case against the parent.
So what I
when you get into court, but that has nothing to do with warrants.
Well, what I found is that a lot of the first cases were actually based on fabrications. As time went on, they pull out more and more information. It has nothing to do with the original charge or whatever allegation. And so when you have a first case where you've lost a child, you've had a public defender that didn't do a good job for you, then you lose all your subsequent children. It's all based on that faulty first case.
Right, right. And that's part of the reason why I say it's never a good idea to just concede these petitions. You know, unless truly, you know, if the allegations are true, well, that's another story. But if they're not true or if they're overstated, which is frequently, there's the truth is frequently lies somewhere between a totally, you know, concocted case for whatever reason and a case where there's, you know, true parental fault. Frequently, there's some somewhat middle ground there where the truth lies.
That's exactly my theory, too.
And if you know, there's that middle ground, then you don't want to be conceding a petition that states more than you did.
What alternatives do you have, David? Because apparently the two of you agree that even though the law requires a warrant, the CPS is so disregards it, it doesn't even know about it in many cases. What should a parent whose children are taken do when the cops arrive at the door and they say it requires a warrant? I guess they could whip out a gun and say, "Back off! This is my house."
Well,
you know,
no,
but,
I
you know,
mean,
I mean, what you know, what do you suggest?
Right, they bring the sheriff.
I don't recommend a breach of the peace. I mean, I'm not suggesting that. And frequently, these cases involve situations where they come to the door and you're not aware that they're coming. So it comes as a surprise, and the parent's really not psychologically prepared to lose their children in 5 minutes. So the only thing that you can really do is once the children are taken, is go to court and complain about it and see if you can get the judge to return them. But the judge isn't going to be looking at the niceties of whether there was a warrant. The judge is going to be focused on whether or not the best interests of the child require that the child be protected.
Well, wait a minute. If the law requires a warrant, the judge's responsibility is to uphold the law. Shouldn't you be standing in the doorway with a copy of the law saying, here's the code section, where's your warrant or where's the imminent danger, give me the statement?
Oh, absolutely. You know? You can do that, but that may not deter them.
Well, it may not deter them. It isn't your. I mean, don't you have your next? If that information is not presented, I mean, if you give them an opportunity to say to state what they consider the imminent danger to be, and they don't do it, if they don't respond to that, don't you? Isn't there a way you can immediately go into federal court or something and demand that the case be quashed because the warrant is bad?
Probably not.
The
reason for that is that the federal courts do not like to interfere with ongoing state judicial proceedings. And they have this doctrine to abstain from interfering with a state case. There are rare situations where they will do it, but it's not the norm, and it's very uphill and very unlikely to succeed.
Well, what about going to a higher state court and saying there's no warrant?
Well, you can do that.
Yeah.
You can do that.
Immediately, I'm talking about. You know, the next day, you know.
You can go to a higher court. Well, first you need to object in the court that your case is in, and if you're not successful, then you could always file usually a petition for a writ of mandate in the Court of Appeal and ask them to decide the issue. Yeah, but the problem is with this, and this is really the problem, is that the focus is, whether you're in the Court of Appeal or you're in the trial court, the focus is going to be on what the best interests of the child are and whether the child needs to be protected. And even if there was a violation of the law, it's like the courts don't really care how the kid got there. Very much similar to another situation where people go and kidnap fugitives in other countries and bring them to the United States for trial. I mean, and the court says, well, we don't really care about the kidnapping. The person's already before us. It's sort of analogous to that. So really the remedy comes down to there's two things that can happen. One is you could file a federal civil rights action at some point challenging the illegal removal, and you could ask the court for some kind of injunctive relief against the agency.
David, I consider RCPS to be especially heinous, and I have seen them make up stories, do anything they can to win. I've actually seen a social worker shake her fist at a judge when she was ordered to return the children of a mother and say, well, I'm going to get these children. I don't care what you say, Judge. I mean, that's how punitive our CPS is. So I want to ask you something, because I have clients whose children now, three of their four children here, have actually been abused in foster care, physically abused.
That's foster care after they were taken by CPS.
After they were taken for their own safety. They went in without a mark on them. And once we made that public, CPS drew in its guns and are now not allowing the parents to see their children without guards posted, not allowed to take the little ones to the bathroom so that they can't check their bodies, because the parents were the ones that found the bruises and the bite marks all over their children.
Right.
And
what happens is, in these situations, once the child's been removed from the parents, usually the visits are going to be supervised.
The visits are supervised, but now they're not. They're with a guard at the door where the parent can't even take her three-year-old to the bathroom.
Right. Well, you know, the only time that would be justified would be if there's a fear that the parent's going to take the child and flee. But other than that, I don't think it's justified. But the issue of the visits is another problem in the system, is that they have these rules, and they're usually unwritten rules, that you're not allowed to discuss the case with your child. And this is to protect your child so that you don't put undue pressure on the child. This is what their rationale would be. But at the same time, it prevents the parent from learning what's really happening with the child, because they're not allowed to talk about anything of substance.
Well, their children came into the visit to talk about how one boy had been choked, one had been thrown on the floor, and the social worker would not allow them to tell their parents and actually return.
What had happened, right.
What had happened, saying it wasn't appropriate talk for a visit. This was the first report of it. So the social workers didn't know. It's not like, well, we know, and it's none of the parents' business. This was news to everyone. So, And do parents have any rights once their children are taken into custody? For instance, these children were taken by a single-parent foster father out of state twice with CPS's permission. He raced motorcycles. He left the children all day in the stands with thousands of people in a state where they didn't know anyone while he raced motorcycles. I mean, their children are supervised. They're good parents in that respect. Their kids have never been just dropped in the middle of, you know, stands and left.
Normally, a foster parent should not be taking a child out of state unless they get a court order to permit that. But the norm is that the child should stay in the state.
Well, this guy was granted a lot of freedoms, you know, and took the children out of state twice.
It sounds like we're talking about a specific case, which actually we talked about on the year before.
Well, David, you know so much. There's certain things that I've been very worried about on this case, so I'm glad you will answer those.
Well, I think that the parents have one of the things the parents can do if you can't get, one way to get the court's attention on this issue is to file a petition for a change of placement if the child's in an abusive foster home.
Well,
that's one possible way around it.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is to file a petition for a writ of habeas corpus.
What is that?
But it's a way of challenging the legality of the conditions under which the child is living.
If the child is no longer in that situation, would you still do it?
If the child's no longer in that situation?
Right. If their home has been moved now?
Well, then you've accomplished it. I mean, then you've gotten the child out of the abuse.
Okay, yeah. The counselor did that.
But all of this presupposes that there's an attorney available who's willing to go to these Herculean lengths.
Yeah, this is my question, David. I'm looking for people who don't have access to attorneys other than these court-appointed FOPs who don't really pay much attention to what the parents want, who actually, in the case of Stacy and Orly, and that's who Roxanne is talking about, it's no big secret, with their four children, they were actually misdirected, according to what they say, to the wrong court at the wrong time by their attorney, and so they missed the entire hearing, according to what they said. What can individuals do themselves? I mean, is there, for example, is there a book that they can go to that will give them the legal forms to be able to file for a writ of habeas corpus, to be able to file a petition for a writ of mandate, all that stuff? I mean, is there some way that individuals can file these things themselves so that they can have some immediate legal recourse once their children are taken?
I suppose that they could, but they would have to go to a law library and they have to dig out some resources, and there are some down there.
There isn't a particular volume you know about that helps people deal with
CPS. There's several volumes. There's one treatise on juvenile courts, California Juvenile Court Practice. Continuing Education of the Bar has a book out about juvenile law. I don't think there are any NOLO books out. NOLO would be great if NOLO had something on this, but I don't think they do.
Well, I think you and Roxanne had better get together and start writing that book right now.
Yeah. It's a real neglected backwater.
I want to ask you one more question.
And it's, you know, it involves such important questions, and yet no one seems to be paying much attention to it.
I want to ask you one more question. This happened to another client of ours, Chaya, and it's happening to my clients. When you have, they got two notices in the mail. One was an 8:30 hearing, that was from the county, and one was 9:30 from their lawyers. And they were very smart. They said, we better be there at 8:30, you know. And as it turned out, it was not in the court where they were directed. The hearing took place at 8 a.m. in the morning, which they had no notification on. What can be done?
Well, that's a question of denying due process, and the solution there is to go to the court and object to it and ask that the all orders made in the case that that hearing be vacated and that they have the hearing again.
And that would need their lawyer to do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and if their lawyer's not doing things like that, then what they can do is go to court and they can make a motion to have their lawyer removed and replaced.
Okay. There we go. That's the place to start.
And then they get another dummy
motion, and it's based on a case called People versus Marsden, M-A-R-S-D-E-N, which is a carryover from the criminal law, which allows criminal defendants with appointed counsel to complain about their lawyers and get them replaced. So if the lawyer is not doing what the lawyer is supposed to do, rank as many Marsden motions as you need to bring it to the court's attention. I have to tell you, courts don't look favorably upon these motions, and they're not often granted. But if you come in with a good enough case of your lawyer just not doing what you want the lawyer to do, then you can get it accomplished.
Is the Marsden motion to get your lawyer fired, or is the Marsden motion what denying due process is called?
Well,
that's to get your lawyer fired.
They're kind of intertwined, because if you're, you know, your lawyer, your court-appointed lawyer isn't giving you the proper attention, you're not getting due process.
That's
something that the court should be concerned about, because in a sense, when a court appoints a lawyer, they're vouching for that lawyer. They're saying that lawyer is a competent
On the
lawyer.
Phone, you have David Beauvais and you have Roxana Quistapache talking about CPS and legal protections that should be but aren't, apparently. Go ahead, Roxanne.
David, we actually...
The other thing I wanted to tell you, just while we're on the subject, is very frequently child's counsel has a lot of power in these cases.
Child's counsel will not be available to anyone. She is completely unavailable.
Okay. But I wanted to point out one other feature of the law that's important is that the parents have the right to object to their children's lawyer if they think the children's lawyer is incompetent.
Ah.
And you can go in there and you can say, hey, you know, my children's lawyer is not, you know, spending time with them, not paying attention to their needs or their wants. Sometimes there's a problem that comes up where the children want one result in the case if they're old enough to say, and a lawyer has a better idea.
That's exactly what's happening, and the lawyer will not let the children call.
That is a real problem, and California law is not real good on this because it sort of recognizes that the children's lawyer has to look out for the best interests of the children, not the stated interests of the children. And when there's that kind of a conflict, then the court should hold a hearing to determine whether or not a guardian ad litem should be appointed for the child to represent the child's stated interests. So Marsden motions can be directed both at your own counsel and also at your children's counsel.
David, what website do you suggest people who are interested in dealing with in getting more information about how to fight CPS or how to essentially do it yourself?
There's a bunch of them. If you just Google CPS, you'll come up with a lot of stuff. One of them is called CPS Watch.
That's still active, or is that a dead site?
I believe it's still active. I haven't looked at it in probably a couple of months, but I think it's still there. And if it's not, there's plenty of others. There's a lot of internet discourse on this subject.
Can I just ask you one clarifying question, David? If the parents want to object to their children's lawyer, does their lawyer need to do that for them?
Yeah, because that of course creates another problem because they're not going to want to do that.
But if they don't want to, don't they have to? If that's what the client wants?
You would think, yeah. I mean, but you're going to find that here's the culture of this situation. This is the problem. All of these people generally work together with each other every day. So to have one of them accusing the other one of being incompetent makes it very uncomfortable for the attorney who's putting forth that position. And
that
so there's a tendency
terrible.
In these courts to be collaborative rather than adversarial. And because of that tendency, you're going to meet a lot of resistance frequently in getting your lawyer to take the stance you want the lawyer to take.
Okay.
And so what should people do to get past that resistance?
Well, unfortunately, the only thing they can really do to get past that resistance is to hire their own lawyer.
Well, now you have it, right?
And who's going to come into the courtroom and probably going to be...
blackballed immediately?
He's going to be considered an outsider, and it's almost like, how dare you crash our tea party? And I remember having that feeling when I was involved in this very protracted dependency case in a court I'd never stepped into before, where everybody was real chummy, and... It was just amazing.
It's like everybody
it wasn't like
works
any other
for the county.
Where you expect it to be adversarial. It was like, how dare you make this an adversary proceeding? You know, how dare you stand up and say that your client didn't do anything wrong?
Well, how dare you really be there for the rights of the children?
Right.
And do you know about the rights of the children? I know the children get a notice in the mail of the court hearing. My understanding is that they are allowed to go. In our county, the judge does not want them in court, even if they want to go, and their lawyer doesn't let them go. She says she will speak for them, but she speaks what she believes is in their best interest. She does not, you know, speak for what they actually want.
I think it depends. This is another one of those depends situations. I mean, I think it depends on the psychological state of the health, the child's emotional, you know, strength, what the allegations are about, whether the child wants to be there or not, what the age of the child is. There's a whole bunch of factors that play into whether it's a good idea for the child to be in court. But I would say this. I think if you have a child who's 8, 9, 10 or years or more, the child wants to be in court, the child should be in court.
I agree.
And what happens if the child is denied that right? The child has to go get another attorney and essentially dump the first attorney or sue for lack of due process?
Or you know, if the parents are aware of it, the parents can raise the issue in public court. The parents don't want to be there.
The parents are
prevented from being there. But the child has a right to be there. That's actually in the code.
And I was told...
So if the judge is saying no children in my court, the judge is not following the law.
I was told that technically, yeah, they have the right by the supervising attorney, but it's just a technicality. It's not...
I don't think it's a technicality at all. I think it's called due process.
Well, isn't the...
And I think it's you know, children, are just like adults, like to have some sense that they have control over their lives. And to be having a court proceeding about them without them being allowed to attend when they want to be there is just outrageous.
Well, isn't perhaps the appropriate thing for a parent to do when that comes up is to insist, Your Honor, I will not attend these proceedings unless the children are allowed to be present. This is a violation of due process, and simply leave?
Well, I don't know if I would do that.
I don't know. I mean, it sounds to me like you have to do something. If you sit around and wait for a process to happen that is stacked against you, I mean, if you say in essence, you have to say this process cannot go forward with the children not present.
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea for the parent to exit the proceedings because the children aren't allowed to be there. I think what's important is to get a record developed that the children, in fact, have been denied the right to be there. And then, if there is a finding of dependency, and then you can appeal. You can go to the higher court, and one of the issues can be, this would be an issue asserted by the children's attorney on appeal, who will be a different attorney from the one they had in the trial court, and is likely to be a better attorney, by the way. That attorney is going to say, hey, these proceedings are void because my client was denied the right to be present.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have a very good issue. Because if you have a trial in absentia, when it's not a voluntary, failure to appear, you have just about a per se reversal from the appellate court.
Put that into English for us.
The appellate court is going to automatically reverse the jurisdictional findings of the juvenile court because the children who wanted to be there were not permitted to be there.
So that's one way that Stacy and Orly Jones can possibly have their children, this matter reversed on appeal. That'd be one
ground. Yeah, but you got to make a record. You got to go in there and make sure that they know that those children want to be there.
How do you make a record when only your lawyer speaks for you?
Well, you make him to the point where you need to fire your lawyer and do it yourself if you don't have any other options.
Okay.
I don't know what else to say about that.
Is there a court stenographer? I mean, can the parents stand up and say, Your Honor, my attorney is not allowing me to speak, but my children want to be present and not allowed to be here? Can you say, I mean, what's
well,
the...
Well, you can. You may be ruled out of order.
But it'll still be on the record, right?
It'll still be on the record.
Yeah.
That sounds to me like what needs to happen.
Yeah, I mean, because if you're going to sit around waiting until they accept you to fire your lawyer and find you another lawyer, all the time the children are being denied these rights, it seems to me you want to get this done as quickly as possible. That's why I suggest...
Well, that would be, like if you were to go with a Marsden motion,
mm-hmm.
That would be an issue that you could potentially raise in a Marsden motion, is to say, hey, the...
Well, that's
going to
be an issue an attorney could potentially raise in a Marsden motion, but I'm talking about a parent.
No, the parent can say, I told my lawyer that I wanted the children there because they told me they really want to be here and they haven't been allowed to be here, and my lawyer refuses to tell you that.
But how and when is he able to make this statement and to what judge? I mean, when does that happen? Weeks later, months later, at the time of the hearing? That's my question.
Well, a Marsden motion can be scheduled in 5 days. I mean... There doesn't have to be.
All right, well, can a parent stand up in court and say, Your Honor, I wish to schedule a Marsden motion to fire my attorney, even if they say you're out of order?
Yeah, they could even be heard immediately.
Okay, then that's what they should do. That's what these people, they should say, I want to fire this attorney, I want the kids in court, and it seems to me that, and I'm just looking for a do-it-yourself book here.
The other thing that I suggest to clients, and this is something I think is really important, is that when you have an attorney who's not willing to commit to defense of you, is to write letters to the attorney and document everything. Document the phone calls you had with the lawyer. Document the meetings. Document what your demands are, what you expect from the case, and when you expect it to happen. And put all that in writing. And then when you go to a Marsden motion, you can give the judge all those letters.
Okay. That's great.
And by the way, these motions are heard what's called in camera without the other side being present. It's just between the parents and the court.
Another question comes up there. Stacy and Orly and other people who have been to CPS hearings has asked for a supporting person to be allowed to be present, and that is universally opposed by the other side. And when I talked to Judge Yontz about it, he initially let me into court the first time because I was the mother asked that I be present. The second time he said, well, I want you to clear it first with the other side. Now, what's the situation with the right of the parent to have a supportive person with them?
It's the confidentiality, of course.
I don't think that there's any statutory right, but I have seen in many cases where courts permit that.
Right, how exciting.
Even over objection of the other side. In fact, I'm involved in one right now in which there's a woman who comes to court every time, and every time she comes, well, for the first 10 hearings, they objected to her being there, and now they've given up.
Mm-hmm.
But that's basically what...
In the audience or at the table of the appearance?
No, usually in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I know about the right of the children to attend... having been a foster mother myself, I let Stacy and Orly know that their children could have the right to appear. Their children are older. They're like 10 and 12 years old. They simply told their children. They've been very aware that their phone calls could be monitored, tapped, listened in to, and they let their children know that you do have the right to go to court, call your attorney, and let her know if that's something you want to do. They're being accused of putting their children up to this, which I...
Of course. That's what they do.
And then the other side of it is that the children's attorney will not let them have her phone number.
The children's attorney
will not let the children have her phone number.
You're kidding me.
No. And supposedly the foster mother has to dial. She's the only one that knows the number, but she refuses to dial the phone. She won't call the attorney. The attorney doesn't want calls.
The children are being kept incommunicado.
They are, because of the abuse.
The whims of the social workers.
That's right. So they're like prisoners.
Right. Right. Well, this is all grist for the mill on
you've been a lot of help, Dan.
The way that the department acts in the case is probative of the witness's credibility when they come in testifying. Because they usually testify very well. They're usually pretty good on the stand because they do it all the time.
Who?
The social workers.
Oh, my gosh, of course.
So they sound very polished and professional, but they're... Frequently, I don't mean to disparage social workers in general because there are some good ones out there, but there are some bad ones, and it's a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde phenomenon. They're terrible when they're outside the courtroom. They're just ferocious, intimidating, and extremely callous and arrogant.
My feeling is,
but when they get on the stand, they sound very understanding and warm and loving, and they just want the best for this family. So it's very psychotic to the ears of the parent because they hear both, and they wonder if the people that are in charge of their case aren't the ones that have the problem instead of them.
How could they wonder that?
The answer is yes.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think that part of this may be that a lot of times people are driven into the social work field because of their own personal problems that they had growing up.
Yes.
And they want to protect children because when they were children, they weren't protected. And so they don't have a balanced perception of what's going on. It's like the carpenter who only sees nails. Everything's a nail. And so every case that comes in is a case of extraordinary abuse. And that whole psychology, I think, is also driving the system.
Well, I maintain, David, that if they have a good case, they don't need to make things up. And every case that I've been in on, they have fabricated, added charges, gone on and on and on. This case that I have right now, I really believe it's because the children are now a liability to the county because they've been abused in foster care, that they will never let them go.
The foster...
FM, Bathrobes Piers Broadsides, Civil Rights on the Streets, and all around the town from 9:30 to 1 o'clock. Our first guest will be Paul Marcelon Simpson?
Sampson.
Sorry there, Paul. He's going to talk about the attempts to distribute information and establish bus rider... Gosh, unions, associations, input, meaningful influence on the policies of the Metro Transit. Is that kind of cover? We're going to be rolling into that in a moment. But before we do, of course, we're going to have a little musical intro. And we've also got coming up Roxana Keys Tapache on CPS, the case of four children stolen from Stacy and Orly Jones, or let's say sequestered for their own good, of course. And then at 11:30, we'll be having the De Anza Trailer Park scandal, the attempt of the city council, actually the intention of the city council next week, September 16th, I believe is when they're going to do it, to destroy rent control at the De Anza Trailer Park. All this and more on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Stay with us. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
5 years since I've had a raise in pay. Way things are going, I could get laid off any day. Sure is hard living with all this pain. I know what I need. I need somebody to blame. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
It's all their fault.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no soul.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They can't get back.
My neighborhood library is about to close. The school my kids go to is becoming a joke. Self-serving liberals blame it on corporate tax breaks. But that's propaganda. I know who I should hate. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs. Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no soul.
Teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs.
They got no class.